do that one first, because we have some people who are not in the building every day who came down just for that issue, so let's try to take public testimony on it first, and then see where it takes us. So with that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 20, and Mr. Putman, when you get a chance to get your stuff together, you can introduce the bill to us.
All right. Mr. Chairman, this bill has a buy-off of both the proponents of the bill and, as I understand it, the State Board of Accountancy. In fact, if the committee goes in favor of this bill, the board will withdraw Senate Bill 282.
Now, there's incentive.
What?
There's incentive.
I wasn't a sales pitch, Mr. Chairman. I just
quite effective. How many more can we run into this baby?
Many other states and national organizations have come to the conclusion that there are circumstances under which public accountants and certified public will not violate the code of ethics if they accept commissions and contingency fees on certain financial products that they may offer or sell through their business. When they do that, though, this bill would require full written disclosure to their client ahead of time. There are amendments to this bill. The amendment allow the board to add definitions of contingency fee beyond those that are already in the law. It requires them to adopt rules defining referral fee and commission, and permits them to go to biannual certificate-related fees, and it permits them to reduce the fees by rule for CPAs and PAs that are 65 and over. And for your information, I'm neither a CPA nor a PA.
Okay, Rob, you want to bring your folks up?
We're doing 20 now.
We passed it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, here in support of Senate Bill 20. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for taking this bill up. It was mistakenly, I guess, in another committee bouncing around for a while, so we're happy to be here, and we're happy to be here on behalf of the bill. With me today, Mr. Chairman, is Mike Lewis, President of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, and also OSCPA Legislative Chair Keith Myers, and they have some brief testimony they'd like to offer on behalf of Senate Bill 20.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, other committee members. My name is Keith Myers. I'm a CPA in public practice in Portland, Oregon, partner at Edwards & Myers CPAs. Also live in West Lynn, Oregon. For about the last 100 years, CPAs have primarily been known for their work in attesting to the accuracy of financial statements for companies in the issuance of financial reports. This work in auditing and reviewing of financial statements has required the CPA to maintain independence at all costs. And because of this, CPAs have historically been prohibited from accepting commissions and referral fees. However, in recent years, especially over the last 20 years, the work of the accountant has begun to change as CPAs, at the request of clients and the marketplace, have begun to provide many services that are unrelated to financial reporting, things like sophisticated tax planning, estate tax planning, computer system installation, human resources management, or just some of the items that CPAs are now involved in, and some of these are areas that the CPA is primarily involved in providing for their clients. Now, about 25% of a large firm's fees are generated through financial reporting, which means basically the lion's share of CPA's work is done in non-attest services, like the ones that I had just talked about. Because of these changes in the profession and in the marketplace, the old laws that currently prohibit commissions and contingent fees and referral fees needs to be changed, and currently the law is no longer appropriate for the marketplace that the CPA finds himself in. Senate Bill 20 removes the prohibition against commissions and referral fees for non-attest services that a CPA is involved in with its clients. Since 1985, 42 states granted the CPAs the ability to accept commissions and referral fees in most situations. 2 weeks ago, the state of Washington, our neighbor to the north, also allowed by rule for CPAs to allow commissions, which makes the total 43 now. Our current law has made for some interesting situations over the last several years. A couple of examples would be a CPA that happens to also have an ownership, even if it's a small ownership, in another company that might happen to sell items that would generate a commission. That would be a violation of the law because it would be considered an indirect referral fee or an indirect commission. A CPA that might have an ownership, in a lot of situations, a CPA firm might split into two. And the two firms, one would do attest services and the other side would do tax planning or might install computer systems for their companies. If a client from the tax side is referred to the computer installation side, that has been construed to be an indirect referral fee and in violation of Oregon law. So CPAs are not allowed to do that. Partners of large firms that might have offices in various other states which allow commissions cannot accept partnership income if the commission is a portion of that income that they receive from the partnership. That has created some problems. CPAs that aren't in public practice at all, that happen to be investment advisors or insurance salesmen, cannot pull themselves out to be CPAs. They can't put it on their business card, can't put it on their letterhead. They can't even really let the client know by having the diploma or their certificate on the back wall to let them know that they are a CPA. To do that would be in violation because they would be considered to be holding themselves out as CPAs. There are other examples that we could go through as well. I'd like to turn the podium over to Mike, who will talk about some of the safeguards that Senate Bill 20 has.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Mike Lewis. I'm the current president of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I am a shareholder in the firm of Jones and Roth with offices in Eugene and Hillsborough. We employ approximately 70 people throughout the state. Keith explained why commissions is important to our clients, to our customers, and the changing environment that we live in, the changing marketplace, and the new global economy, basically. I'd like to explain to you some of the safeguards that are built into Senate Bill 20 to protect our customers and our clients and the public, as well as our current regulatory environment that also affords our clients and the public protection. First, within Senate Bill number 20, we have two safeguards. One is that you, as Keith mentioned earlier, you cannot perform attest services for your clients and receive a commission. Now, attest services are those services where we're performing some assurance to our clients. For example, an audited financial statement or a reviewed financial statement or a compilation financial statement for our clients or other attestation services, which I won't go into. We can issue a compilation financial statement if we say we're not independent in that financial statement. Otherwise, we cannot. The second safeguard within Senate Bill 20 is that it requires a written disclosure to our clients of the fee arrangement that we're going to enter into, the commission or referral fee. This written disclosure is required even if there's only an expectation that there's going to be a commission or a referral fee. And I don't believe I know of any other profession that requires this level of disclosure to their clients when they're accepting a commission. The public is also protected by our own regulation, both the Oregon Board of Accountancy and our own self-regulation. The State Board of Accountancy has authority to enforce the law. One of my roles in moving up the leadership of the Oregon Society of CPAs was to be the board liaison for the society to the State Board of Accountancy. And I observed firsthand how diligent they were in enforcing the accountancy laws in the state. And they've done a very good job, and I'm very proud to be part of the state and the licensing. The second requirement of the State Board of Accountancy is they are now requiring continuing professional education in ethics. This is a relatively new requirement, and I believe this is the first year it's effective. When that new rule became effective, the idea was that the continuing education would deal with real-life situations in Oregon as they arise to help our members, or the licensees, rather, understand what the current laws are. The CPA profession is required by our own code of professional ethics to only provide those services to our clients where we're properly trained or supervised. It was interesting to me, I recently attended an American Institute of Certified Public Accountants meeting. Bob Elliott was a chair at that meeting of the AICPA, and he mentioned the new services that CPAs are going into, and he said something to me that stuck with me. He said that it's not that we're performing these services or core values, it's that we're going to perform these services and the core values. Core values meaning independence, integrity, and objectivity. As we go in these services, we still need to maintain those core values that we've always maintained as a profession, and we will do that. Oregon law requires CPA firms who perform audits, reviews, or compilation financial statements to go through a peer review. That peer review requirement is every 3 years. Another CPA firm that's qualified, another CPA reviewer, goes into the firm and reviews the elements of quality controls of those firms. They look at independence, integrity, and objectivity. I am a reviewer. I do reviews of other CPAs from Oregon, Washington, California, and Alaska. And we look at the elements of quality control. If there's a problem with the firm, we issue a letter of comments. That letter of comments then is addressed by the firm and by the administrating entity of the peer review program, and that entity, in this case, the Oregon Society of CPAs, administers the Oregon program, but it is has oversight by the State Board of Accountancy, can and often does issue sanctions on that firm. They require them to have additional continuing education. They require another reviewer to come in and look at their practice to help those firms. The receipt of commissions by CPAs could be subject to CPA firm to other licensure requirements. For example, it is illegal to share revenue with an investment advisory firm as a CPA without actually having a license either through the Oregon security law or through the SEC. So there are CPAs that start or begin to offer additional type of services to their clients are still going to be subject to whatever licensure rules are going to be in effect for that service. This is a nationwide movement, as Keith has mentioned. There are 43 states that currently accept commissions. It's interesting to me there's only very few states that have a prohibition on commissions in their statute. Those that are requiring a prohibition in statute are Idaho, Rhode Island, and Oregon, probably only three. The other eight states and jurisdictions, which are the Virgin Islands and San Juan, have a prohibition in their rule, not in their statute. And they're proceeding to change the law, too. They see the need for the change in the world, the new global economy, and the marketplace, and they're moving rapidly to make those changes. One of the things I did as the president of the society to get a feel from our members as to whether or not this is something they would really want to move forward on is I held a series of town hall meetings throughout the state, and I visited a good part of the state, Eastern Oregon, Coast, Central Oregon, Northern Oregon, to find out what our members really wanted and whether this is something that was important to them. And this is a universal, strong feeling by our members that they really would like to see the prohibition on commissions removed so they can be more competitive in the marketplace. Some of these people I talk to border other states like Washington, and they feel that in order for them to compete, they're going to have the flexibility for an additional or different type of fee arrangement. You'll hear from the State Oregon Board of Accountancy in a few minutes. They firmly support our bill and feel strongly about the issues. And I would open it up now to any questions you might have of me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does this bill, would it also affect the PAs?
Yes, it would.
Are they in agreement with these changes?
Mr. Chairman, Rob Douglas for the record. We generally don't speak for the public accountants.
you speak to them?
Yes, we do. And to date, we've not heard any opposition from them.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Warby.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Have you had conversation with the Ethics Commission about their opposition to the bill?
The Ethics Commission?
Oregon.
The Oregon
Board of Accountancy,
Board of Accountancy has a complaint committee that deals with complaints in Oregon. But I have not talked to the complaints committee about this issue. I've talked to the Board of Accountancy.
Are you familiar with Mr. Polk, Arnie Polk?
I am.
He was a Beaverton CPA?
Yes, I am.
He's signed to testify.
Okay, all right. I'll hold my question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Polk's going to get to this. He lives in my district, but I think I should ask you guys the question so that you have a chance to respond to at least one of the criticisms of this notion is that it alters the relationship between customer and CPA. And sometimes, hypothetically, my interest would not be the first interest that were served if that type of relationship, if Senate Bill 20 is passed and a new contingent fee structure is in place.
Mr. Chairman, answer that?
Go ahead.
One of the concerns we had early on, I think, was that very issue. And again, as in my leadership role for the Oregon Society of CPAs, I was able to attend some of the State Board of Accountancy meetings. And they had, as a guest speaker at one of those meetings, the administrator from Florida. And we asked the administrator for Florida what their experience was as far as commissions legislation and issues on integrity and objectivity. They have had the law at that time for approximately 15 years. She told us they basically had one complaint in all that time, and it was not a very valid, significant complaint. We don't know what others' state experience is because information isn't always available. But we get the sense in talking to the AICP that it has not been an issue. As I stated earlier, we think we can move into these services, and it's these services and integrity, objectivity, and independence, not or. And I think that's been the case. I think we're very concerned about our profession keeping that level of core values.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And on the disclosure, mm-hmm. I, as a consumer, when I sign my contract, how would I see the disclosure information?
It's going to be a written disclosure requirement, and we have deferred that to the Board of Accountancy as to how that disclosure might happen, because we wanted them to have the flexibility, since they are the regulators and are going to have the responsibility to deal with the CPAs to be able to draft however they would like that to be.
And Mr. Chair, are you open to us doing that in statute, spelling out how the disclosure would look in statute?
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have anybody from the other profession signed up, real estate, insurance, stockbrokers, anybody?
No, I don't think so. We've got Board of Accountancy and people.
What's going to be, okay, thank you. What's going to be their reaction when they finally read this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, I think it's important to remember this doesn't give the CPA any exemption from any other licensing that may be required. So if you're going to throw them into another pot, they have to go right through the same licensing requirements that those folks have.
So do you... So just a standard licensing requirement, and they won't think this is unfair competition because you're dealing with them on multiple levels? Or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, on the contrary, we've had some of the professions contact us and say, why don't we have this in Oregon? We'd like to work with you as part of a team to provide these kind of services.
Okay. So my phone won't be ringing off the hook.
He didn't say that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Dennis Donnelly, you've checked your more than 100 miles from, so would you come up next? I see you're with the state board, and unfortunately we're probably going to get back to these things on Friday. Are you going to have to come back then?
Well, that remains to be seen, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm Dennis Donnelly. I'm a partner in Kosmatka Donnelly & Company in Medford, Oregon. I am the current chair of the State Board of Accountancy and have been involved with the State Board of Accountancy for quite a few years, serving up through the committees. I've served on the Qualifications Committee. I've served on the Complaints Committee prior to being actually a board member, so I'm pretty familiar with the operations of the board even before I came on. The State Board of Accountancy's licensees, both CPAs and PAs, are being solicited daily by vendors of commission-based products and services that are provided to CPAs in other states. Our licensees are confused about what they can or may do in regard to these proposals from these vendors. In a rapidly growing and changing environment and the move to electronic commerce, the public is not aware of the restriction on Oregon licensees in the area of commissions and which apply to CPAs and PAs. The board receives requests from licensees who would like to form business relationships with parties that are selling commission-based products, and they're unsure of what is permitted and what is not permitted. In response to these inquiries, the board solicited a draft opinion from the Department of Justice to clarify the extent of this prohibition. The AG concluded that the prohibition is broad and encompasses activities performed even in related ownership entities. So if a CPA or a PA was an owner in a practice doing accounting and also a member of a entity that was providing products or services that was receiving commissions, this would be prohibited. There are no provisions in Senate Bill 20 that allow CPAs or PAs to accept commissions from clients that they also perform at attestation services. Attestation services require independence. The proposed receipt of commission and or referral fee requires disclosure and advance notifications to clients. We've discussed the requirement of the disclosure among the board members, and I can assure you that it will be a written requirement, probably somewhat along the line of a representation letter that we get from our clients in audit situations or review situations, and the client will have to sign off on this disclosure. That isn't part of the Senate bill. It will be part of the rules, but I'm sure my colleagues on the board would agree that that would be a desirable requirement. The board believes these safeguards are adequate safeguards for the public. In addition, the board feels that through the rulemaking process, we can build other safeguards into the statute to protect the public. The State Board of Accountancy is supporting Senate Bill 20.
Thank you. Questions? It's what? Carl, is it Rivers?
No, it's Carol.
Carol?
Reeves.
Reeves. Okay.
Butchered that one.
And Arnie Polston will come at the same time, so we can...
Mr. Chair, I really don't have additional testimony for the board.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Arnie Polk?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Reeves used to work for us, so she knows what unnecessary testimony.
Mr. Chair, Senators, appreciate the opportunity of being here and explaining to you why Senate Bill 20, and in my testimony I'll refer to Senate Bill 282 as well, should not be passed. These both laws attempt to change existing Oregon law that's been on the books since, I believe, 1989. And if they are passed, they will destroy the independence and objectivity of, that the public has come to expect from CPAs, and it will put CPAs and PAs potentially in a conflict of interest situation with their clients. This would be a disservice to the public and would not be a good thing for the citizens of the state of Oregon. My name is Arnold Polk. I've been a CPA licensed in Oregon for 30 years. I'm also an attorney licensed in Oregon and have been for 20 years. I'm currently a member of the Oregon Board of Accountancy's Complaints Committee, and I've been on that committee for approximately 5 years. I'm a former member of the Oregon Society of CPAs Ethics Committee. I'm here today speaking only as a concerned citizen, not a representative of the society, nor a representative of the Board of Accountancy, or any other entity. The Complaints Committee that I serve on for the board is charged with investigating complaints against CPAs for violations of Oregon law and administrative rules. As a member of that committee, I try to protect the public from ethical violations by CPAs. The profession of public accountancy is an old profession. We heard testimony about that earlier. And over the years, the scope of the practice has grown, as we've heard earlier. The reason the profession has grown into these ancillary fields is because of the trust that the profession has engendered by being objective and independent. It started from the attestation function, performing audits that were used by third-party users of financial statements, and the profession gained a tremendous amount of respect. It has enabled the profession to branch into tax services, management advisory services, and the whole panoply of other services that you've heard about earlier today. Since 1989, Oregon law, and that's ORS 673-345, paragraph 1, has prohibited CPAs from paying a commission to obtain a client or accepting a commission for referring a client to products or services of others. The reason for these statutory prohibitions is to assure the public that a CPA acting as a trusted advisor for his client will not be influenced by anything other than the best interest of the client. In other words, the legislature did not want a CPA to receive, and this is my term, kickbacks from third-party providers. Portions of Senate Bill 282 and Senate Bill 20 will change that. After reading a legislative concept that has become, is now Senate Bill 82, the members of the Complaints Committee sent a letter to the Board of Accountancy, and I'd like to read that letter to you. It's addressed to the Board of Accountancy. It says, "Gentlemen, we, members of the Board's Complaint Committee, have had an opportunity to review and wish to comment on the Board's legislative concept 120,000/1. This concept would authorize licensees to receive payment from third parties for referral or recommendation of products or services of others. On several occasions, this committee has discussed the issue of licensees receiving payments from third parties. It is our recollection that each discussion has concluded that allowing licensees to receive payments for the referral of services or products of others would not be in the best interests of the public or the profession. The reasons for these conclusions are as follows. 1. The judgment of the licensee may be influenced by the amount of payment to be received. 2. The judgment of the licensee may be subordinated to influences exerted by the third-party payors. 3. As a result of the above, the public's perception of the integrity and objectivity of the CPA profession may be diminished. I believe that was introduced into a regular meeting of the Board of Accountancy. I prepare income tax returns for approximately 100 clients a year. My clients ask me for referrals to financial advisors, insurance salesmen and for other products. They expect me to have only their interest in my mind when I'm thinking of who to refer them to or what products to refer them to. They don't expect me to receive a payment from this third-party provider. The bills as drafted would authorize CPAs to have a direct conflict of interest with their clients. The CPA would be torn between his obligation to his client and the possible financial benefit to the CPA from receiving, in the words of the bill, a commission from a third-party provider, my words, kickback. This situation would be untenable for the CPA, and it would place the citizens of Oregon at risk. I therefore ask this committee to continue the law that's been in effect in Oregon for years and delete the provisions of those two bills that deal with allowing CPAs to receive commissions.
In my mind, a referral is completely different from performing the duty. Referring somebody to an insurance agent or being an insurance agent, those are kind of two boxes, I think. One could be subject to the kickback aspect of life. The other one could be, if they're a duly licensed insurance agent, I can provide that service also if you'd like me to. Am I reading this thing correctly? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, as I read the bill, it would allow CPAs, myself for as an example, client comes to me and says, Arnie, or worse yet, I do a tax return for a client and I note that they have a need for some insurance product. As I'm counseling with my client, I say to the client, you should have some insurance. Why don't you go talk to my good friend, Bill, the insurance agent? And I may refer the client to Bill for one of two reasons. One, because Bill has the best products available that will serve my client's needs. Or two, I may get some kind of a fee back from Bill for making the referral to him. And that's the insidious harm that this bill would allow.
Would that be different from, you need some insurance, you know, let's walk over here and I'll open up my insurance desk. Would that be the same thing, same conflict, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, in that situation, I think we start running into some rules that we used to have and have no longer, and that would be the incompatible occupations rule that have been battered about in the profession for a number of years. In that situation where the CPA is wearing two hats, you ought to have some insurance to perhaps fund an estate tax liability, changes chairs, puts on his other hat and says, and here's what you should have. At least that is a face-to-face, one-to-one relationship that I think clients are more likely to understand than something that's referred out to a third party in exchange for a fee.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Chair, in the case of Bill, the insurance guy, I need clarification on this. Isn't it required in the bill that if you had a financial relationship with that guy, that you would have to disclose that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, yes, the bill does require disclosure. It's been my experience with my clients that when they come to me because of the fiduciary relationship that I have with them, or almost fiduciary relationship, I put something in front of them, they sign it. They think I'm looking out for them. If the bill does pass, I think it would be an excellent idea to have very strong statutory language requiring the exact kind of disclosure, including the amount of the fee, why the referral was made, and other things like that, so that the public will at least be hit, you know, head on and be told the exact situation that the CPA is providing.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So I think we heard earlier that they were willing to have
a statutory versus a rulemaking addressing of that issue. The other sort of question would be, nothing in this bill requires an accountant to have a relationship with another provider of insurance, or in your example, insurance. I'm sure you could have other examples of as well that are economic, but there's nothing that requires a CPA to go out and create an economic relationship, kickback relationship, if you will, with anybody, is there?
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Afternoon, Arnie. Just working this through in my mind, if you have the strong disclosure in statute, and given the previous testimony that almost every state has adopted some form of this, does that get us where we need to be, where you have some strong disclosure, mindful of the fact that many other states do have this provision and do not seem to be experiencing grave difficulties as far as I've been able to discern?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, my druthers are to keep the profession pure and to avoid allowing CPAs to put themselves in a conflict situation. Living in the real world, if I can't have the perfect world, strong disclosure would be good. And as far as I think we heard testimony about the lack of information from other states about the effects of this bill. I don't know if there's been any investigation to determine if there has been any harm or if it's just a lack of reporting situation. Is that responsive to your question, sir?
It is. Thank you.
Okay. Under this bill, and I don't know if you would know the answer to this, and if not, Rob or somebody else, hopefully can come up. What in the case of the referral you've talked about, when would that disclosure need to be made? Would that be made at the point in time when I, the CPA, refer the person to Bill to go get insurance? That I may, in fact, before you can go to Bill, you have to sign this that says I may be receiving a payment from Bill? Or would it be when Bill sells the product to me or to the client, then the client signs a statement saying that I recognize the fact that my CPA is receiving a quote-unquote kickback?
Senator Beyer, I think in order for it to be effective, it has to be before the referral is made, or at least contemporaneously with the referral.
Okay, but do you know when it would be required by this bill?
No, I don't. I believe that the testimony has been that the bill is silent as to the disclosure.
Rob, you want to come up and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you look on the original bill, page 4, down there toward the bottom where it talks about subsection 5, shall disclose the expectation, acceptance, or payment to the client. So if we're about to enter a situation where it's possible you could get into that situation, it does have to be disclosed.
Which one are you on, Rob?
Line 2425, page 4 of the original bill.
Okay. So it's your opinion by that language, the disclosure would have to be made at the time of the referral?
In anticipation of the referral, right. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have no one else signed up to testify in this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20. And I think we won't do a work session just yet on this bill. We're going to have the accounting issues back in front of us again on Friday. So we'll think about it between now and then. Did you have a question you want to make?
No. I'm playing with my man.
Okay.
The disclosure, the concepts, words, amendments, something like that.
Yeah.
We can talk about that Friday.
We can talk about that Friday and the putting disclosure requirements into the bill as far as forms or something like that. I personally am hesitant to put forms in statute. I think that's a mistake, but I'm willing to listen to arguments on either side. I guess I'd also like to...
The Republicans are all about big government, Mr. Chair, and creating forms and bureaucracy. We don't want that.
I would also like to entertain the idea the people, either the Board of Accountancy or someone, the thought of, rather than seven bills dealing with this subject, one, maybe two. So I would like to have you start thinking about combinations of which bills can go into what here. So when we move something forward, we don't have to move six or seven bills. We can only move one or two.
Mr. Chair, maybe we could move these into the PERS bills and all do one big bill for
the
committee.
There you go. Relating to Oregon. thank you. We will take up this issue again. Well, possibly this afternoon if we have time after 45, but I'm anticipating on Friday. So thank you very much for coming down today. And hopefully those of you who travel long distance won't have to travel that way again.
Mr. Chairman, I think you may possibly be sending some people out of the room who might not want to leave because if 485 goes quickly, you will want to stay around.
That's true.
We get a choice of who to send out of the room?
I vote for Senator Corcoran.
Second.
This is going to be a bipartisan issue.
Okay, but let's just do mine on Friday.
Okay. Yes, we may get back to these issues before the end of the day, so. Okay.
No, here's my escort out right now.
We will open a work session on Senate Bill 485. Committee members, we have in front of us a rough draft of amendments accepted by MLAC and amendments accepted by MLAC and a hand-engrossed version with MLAC's amendments. So, Keith, we'll let you. Why don't you just bring John up right now? And
yes, I asked Mr. Schultz to come up. If I would be permitted to say, I think they've done an outstanding piece of work in gathering a lot of information together in a very short period of time. And for the committee, I'd thank you, John, for all the work you've put into this. The last time we met, you had a 20-some page document, I think, with a number of issues, concerns, and a variety of answers to those concerns. I had the opportunity to watch both sessions of MLAC dealing with those issues, and they now have a couple dozen proposed solutions that are on this document that I sent to you called Amendments Accepted by the Management Labor Advisory Committee. These amendments are all conceptual in nature. Indeed, some of them simply tell legislative council, we want to do this, and don't even suggest language, simply intent. Others, where, in my opinion, the change is more of a Scrivener's issue of specific language is there. And I attempted in this document to combine what I saw here into the bill itself. And it's possibly imperfect, but in any event, I think the committee, if John went through and explained the thinking behind some of the items that are on here, and you may have questions to him or to others about some items that are not on there.
Okay, and for the committee's information, I don't plan on moving any amendments today or anything like that. This is a chance to look at what's been proposed. These amendments, if they haven't already gone to legislative council, they will be probably as soon as we're done talking about them today. And but this is a chance for us to be updated on what has been done, and if we want to make suggested changes, then before it goes to legislative council, this is an opportunity to maybe make suggestions, and then when they come back in LC form, we have a chance to officially adopt or reject any such changes. So, John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. MLAC met yesterday and reviewed the amendments that had been forwarded through several meetings, including in front of this committee, from various parties. They accepted the amendments that are listed in the memorandum that you have in front of you. MLAC is going to meet again on March 1st. Their preference is to review the amendments at that time in LC form, hopefully, get them from Legislative Council. They want to check it again, make sure they've got it right. Also, they did not review the applicability section and the effective dates. There is the last page of the memorandum you have in front of you lists the recommendations in front of them. I don't expect many issues to arise out of that, but I did want to let you know that that is one part of the bill that they have not amended yet. But what they did do was go through literally dozens of amendments. As you know, it's a big bill, and there were quite a few amendments, and I'll quickly go over the amendments that they accepted. In the first section, which relates to pre-existing conditions, they made what I would term six technical amendments, or as Mr. Putman indicated, almost in some points at the level of Scrivener's corrections. The first one relates to correcting an unintended avenue of denial of omitted condition claims. That wasn't intended in the bill. It was just the way the bill was drafted. It allowed for an avenue of denial that was not considered appropriate by the committee. That's one that's being referred to Legislative Council for review and amendment. There was a couple of deletions of words, deleting...
That's it.
For purposes of this paragraph only, deleting a reference to occupational disease that arises in an injury standard, and in workers' compensation law, it's always appropriate to separate what's an industrial injury and what's an occupational disease, because there are different standards that apply. There was a definition of arthritis that I know this committee heard a lot about. There was an awful lot of controversy about that definition. MLAC moved to just delete the definition out of the law, since it was creating a lot of controversy. There is no definition in the current law.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
We have this hand in growth with MLAC's proposed amendment, and it doesn't show would the entire last sentence then be deleted for the purpose of this paragraph only?
And I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman. The copier ate that page, and when I made the new page, I forgot to delete that.
Deleted from here on? Okay.
Yes, it'd be on page 4, lines 14 through 16. It should be deleted. And again, there's a couple of technical corrections that follow. To make the literal wording of the statute make more sense.
Just a second, John. I've got to go back to that again. You're just deleting lines 14 through 16?
Just that sentence.
The sentence talking about arthritis?
It deletes the definition of arthritis.
We still got arthritis as a pre-existing condition identified above that in the bill.
The amendment that I have is that it deletes the definition of arthritis from the...
Yes, but we're still keeping arthritis as an exception for a pre-existing condition in the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, the arthritis exception is still in the bill.
And so, Mr. Chair,
yes,
the deletion starts on line 12, is that correct?
I think it starts on line 14 with the for the purpose of this paragraph.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Senator Gordley, on line 12, mm-hmm. delete the words for the purpose of this paragraph only.
Right.
Just delete that. Then go down to line 14 and delete the sentence that begins in the middle of line 14.
for the purpose of this paragraph only?
Yes.
And through line 16.
Arthritis remains. We don't need words about for this paragraph only, so they go away. And the definition of arthritis goes away, and is probably going to end up being defined in the common law.
That is my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Court.
Yes.
Translation.
Okay. Senator Harbor.
Yes, sir. Why would you kick the can like that? Why don't you just define it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, there were amendments to expand the definition to define it, I think, further, and there were amendments that the definition was too broad as it stood. I think there were arguments on both sides, and MLAC's response to that yesterday was to delete the definition.
There may
be another person who can maybe address why that was the answer better than I could at this point.
Have the courts already defined what arthritis is so we don't have to go back through and litigate this thing word by word at a later date? I mean, is there a common law definition of arthritis? Is there something that can be pointed to someplace that says this is what we mean?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that, and I can research that. That's something that we can research. There's certainly definitions of arthritis in the medical literature. There is not a definition of arthritis in the current statute.
There used to be.
That was one proposed, anyway.
You know, when are we going to make this guy go through the courts?
Mr. Chair, do other states have definitions of arthritis that we could borrow from, and was that discussed in MLAC?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I'm not aware of any other state that defines arthritis, but I did not hear that discussed at MLAC either.
And you're not getting any backup from the audience.
A whole bunch of poker players behind you. Okay, let's forge ahead.
Okay.
Need many people to go home.
Mr. Chair, and MLAC does want to review this again. So I certainly there's members of MLAC or has been members of MLAC here in the audience.
Not
and,
quite all of them have left.
And my guess is they may want to revisit this. The other reference in Section 1, the last reference, was to make sure that both the aggravation standard and the board's own motion standard were operative in claims for occupational disease. So again, another technical fix. Section 3 had rather more substantive amendments in it. As you'll remember, Section 3 related to the issue of paying time loss for workers who have more than one job. And our current law in Oregon is that if a worker is working more than one job, they are only compensated for wage loss from the job at injury. The bill was amended in terms of changes were in three ways. First was there had been a 40-hour cap put on maximum time loss benefits, and that was removed by an amendment that is proposed. And basically, this change will affect the calculation of what's known as temporary total disability benefits or time loss benefits, your compensation for missing work, such that the maximum benefit would for workers with multiple jobs would equal the maximum benefit for any other worker, which is also proposed in the bill to be moved to 133% of the Oregon average weekly wage. The second change is that the director of Department of Consumer and Business Services would administer the additional benefits that are paid under this section. And this is a change from the original proposal, which would have had the insurer or the self-insured employer at injury administer these benefits. And the third change is to amend the agreement to include time loss for workers who have multiple jobs that are disabled from their additional employment but not their job at injury that they can collect time loss. And how that works is if a worker is working jobs A and B, they're injured on job A. The way the bill was written, if they're not disabled from job A but were disabled from job B, they did not collect any time loss benefits. And this amendment allows them to collect time loss benefits in that scenario when they're not disabled from job A but disabled from job B. One of those technical issues that will come up almost immediately in workers' compensation. All three of these amendments will increase slightly the overall system impact on costs. We don't have an estimate yet for the total because these are rather new. We do estimate the second increase of just having the director administer anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000 a year, depending on the type of administration that will require. That would have been spent by the insurer, the self-insured administrator anyway, so it's basically just a cost shift. It's not an additional cost to the system. Section 5, there was a conforming issue that needed to be taken care of because of the changes in Section 3. Section 5 relates to how time loss will be reimbursed for workers with multiple jobs, and this just basically says that the director is going to make those payments directly or use a third-party administrator to do that for workers. There were some changes in Section 11 which related to the board's own motion. The board's own motion is used when a worker claim has been closed for 5 years, so you're out pretty far after a workers' compensation claim has been closed originally, and a worker wants to get the claim reopened to access additional benefits because of a worsening of their condition. There's basically three technical amendments that will serve to streamline administration of this portion of the bill, and also to clarify who's responsible to do what. These were amendments that were brought forward by various parties and are essentially streamlining and clarification amendments. Section 12 is titled on your handout, Refusal of Offer of Modified Employment, but it also dealt with worker depositions, and you heard a lot of testimony on the worker deposition side of this, even though most of the bill language relates to when workers may refuse offers of modified employment. The First Amendment dealt with refusals of offers of modified employment, and it just added language when a worker is allowed to refuse an offer of modified employment if the way the language did basically work was if the employer had no written shift change policy and they required the worker to change shifts, the new language would basically add, or if the offer of modified employment is not consistent with the common practice of the employer at injury or the employer at aggravation. So it pretty much does two things. And the first part was in response to the restaurant industry testifying that they have a lot of variable shifts and don't necessarily consider their workers changing shifts, and so they wanted some language in there about common practice of the employer that was considered, so workers would not be able to refuse offers of modified employment in that industry when it's common practice that workers work different shifts. And then secondly, there was a request that not only the job at injury be considered, but if the worker was already back to work and with a new employer and their injury had aggravated, that they could go back to work on light duty with their employer at aggravation as well. And so these changes are ways to, again, promote return to work, and their technical amendments that should streamline the administration of that. The other two amendments were in regard to worker depositions. This was the issue of allowing the worker, when they appeal their permanent partial disability award, an opportunity to testify in regard to their condition at closure. And there were concerns about the cost of that deposition, and so language was added to be very explicit about what would be paid for out of a worker deposition, and that was the cost of a court reporter and one original transcript, etc. You can read it there, but it was just to be very clear about what was going to be paid for so that those deposition costs weren't prohibitively expensive. And then also that there was a clarification added that the order on reconsideration, that first level of appeal, would not be stayed in order to allow a waiting for the deposition, and that deposition could be entered into the record even if it came after the time that the statute says the order on reconsideration must be issued. What that does is it doesn't slow down the process, and it allows the worker's deposition to be entered into the record at the next level of appeal if they take it that far. The next area was a pretty substantive change to the original proposal about independent medical examinations, and you probably remember there was quite a bit of testimony about this issue. The substantive change in how this now works is to amend the statute so that insurers retain their authority to select the independent medical examiner, as they currently do, but it now allows a worker to request an examination, much like a medical arbiter is selected, if the worker has requested a hearing on a denial of their claim, and the denial is based upon the independent medical examination report, and the worker's attending physician is not concurring with that report. So there's basically a three-level test that will allow a worker to get examined by an impartial examiner, which was the point of the original proposal, without interfering with insurers' rights to select independent medical examiners.
Mr. Chair. Senator Garber. This timely, John, is that 10 days? Can you say? It says timely.
Yes.
Timely request for the hearing on denial.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, there is a specific timeliness standard in the statute that a worker must request a hearing. Off the top of my head, I just don't remember what that is, and somebody behind me probably could say. But
I don't get any backup.
I can get that information for you, and Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I'd have that sent over to Mr. Putman.
It's in statute now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
And workers are advised as to the amount of time that they must request a hearing.
Thanks.
And finally, a final amendment in that area is that this entire issue would only apply to examinations that are performed in Oregon. There are injured workers who don't reside in Oregon, and it's only practical to have the independent medical examination performed somewhere outside of the state so the worker doesn't have to return to Oregon. The next section was the section on interim medical benefits, and as you probably remember, there was the most testimony about this area, and the idea that the original bill was trying to address was the issue of workers who are injured and not able to access medical care while it is determined which insurer is going to be responsible, either the health benefit plan or the workers' compensation insurer, and sometimes workers have a period of time where they are not able to access a necessary surgery or something like that while it's being determined who's responsible. So the original proposal was to have a limited number of medical benefits provided for, paid for by the workers' compensation insurer, and then there was rights of recovery listed for the workers' compensation insurer. The bill, there were a lot of amendments to this section, and MLAC looked at all of them and selected 7 or 8 amendments to add to it. The first one is to add a provision that allows the insurer to not pay for the interim medical care, the workers' compensation insurer, to not pay for the interim medical care if they deny the claim within 14 days of the employer's date of knowledge. This would be equivalent to how it works on the indemnity side of workers' compensation. And what I mean by that, the time loss benefits are not due if an insurer denies the claim within 14 days of the employer's date of knowledge. And this basically gets to the issue of claims that are filed by a worker who perhaps lists the wrong employer, or the employer is not the employee, the employer is not the employer of the worker, or there's another responsible insurance company. There are claims that are filed by mistake, and it allows for a brief period, 14 days, for an insurer or a self-insured employer to issue a denial and not be responsible for any of the interim medical benefits. The second area was that up until the 14-day, after the 14-day denial period has passed, and if the insurer has not issued a denial, then medical benefits are guaranteed up to a date of decision by the insurer, but they're not payable until the date of the decision. And we had medical providers basically come in and testify that they were not essentially worried typically until 60 days or so have passed, that in terms of the payment for the vast majority of workers, because the vast majority of workers have some sort of insurance coverage. Then that all medical benefits that are provided would be subject to the workers' compensation fee schedule, just as if they were an accepted claim. And this, the concept here is that if a workers' compensation insurer is going to pay as if the claim was accepted, then the standards for accepted claims should apply, such as the fee schedule. And there are some others that I'll touch on as we go along. If the claim is ultimately denied, the health insurer, if any, pays according to the terms and conditions of their policy, and then the workers' compensation insurer pays the balance, if any, is due. There is also an amendment to narrow the definition of some of the language that's used in the bill about health insurance, and to change some of the language regarding subrogation, because some of the health benefit plans, they work differently, and some of the language is not going to work for some of the health benefit plans, and we got some testimony on that, and some of that may need to be revisited with legislative counsel. Well, it certainly is going to need to be discussed with legislative counsel regarding the right language that will work for both sides. It also, the bill was amended to require medical providers to submit a Form 827. That's just a notice of claim form within 72 hours, so that physicians need to notify insurance companies when a claim is being filed. That requirements for medical payments in a disputed claim settlement would apply. That's, again, applying existing law to these claims. So, for example, if the claim is denied, there's existing law about how medical bills have to be settled in a denial situation, and this would just apply that law. There's an amendment also to clarify the dispute resolution process, and this is a sort of an interesting little twist. Today, all of our dispute resolution processes pertain to accepted claims. What we're talking about in this situation is paying interim medical benefits on claims that may ultimately be denied, but it still may be possible that somebody disputes whether the medical services that were provided are reasonable or necessary. And so if that dispute arises, we needed to create a little bit different language how to resolve those disputes under workers' compensation law, because our law today only talks about accepted claims. And then finally, there is what I call the OR amendment, and this is an amendment that basically says if interim medical benefits are paid from the workers' compensation system, then all those benefits should be subject to the same standards as our accepted claims. And perhaps the easiest thing to do, rather than putting in a lot of these other amendments, would just be to amend any part of the statute that might conflict with payment of interim medical benefits. So in other words, they're giving legislative counsel some discretion to say, if there's an easier way to write the statute other than the way it's currently written, go ahead and pick that. So they're giving an opt-out situation for legislative counsel on this.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Garnishment, John? We didn't...
They didn't amend garnishment. Mr. Chair, excuse me. Senator Harper, they did not amend garnishment.
Any thoughts on that? Huge amount of testimony. Enormous amount.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, there was an enormous amount of testimony here, and there was an enormous amount of testimony in front of MLAC on garnishment. They have not chosen to amend that at this point.
Were there any amendments offered dealing with garnishment?
Mr. Chair, yes, there were. There were several amendments offered on garnishment.
Can you tell us why they chose not to accept any amendments on the garnishment provision?
Mr. Chair, no, I can't. I'm not privy to why. I would only be guessing to provide you my opinions on that.
Well, that I guess it brings up an interesting question. Is one of the things that I had asked MLAC and the committee to do for us is on rejected amendments, tell us why you rejected them, and that wasn't done on any of them.
Mr. Chairman, let me interject. John mentioned to me that request of yours, and since he doesn't know the reason for some of these, I told him he didn't need to bring it in since he didn't know the reasons.
Okay.
So,
I guess my interest here was more... And I've been at ease somewhat because there were some accepted amendments, but I was concerned of MLAC taking it as a package and looking at the whole thing and saying, no, we like what we have today, send it back. Obviously, that wasn't done, but so you can't answer. There was considerable debate on the garnishment amendments, and they were discussed and just all rejected for one reason or another.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There was a substantial number of witnesses, and there was quite a bit of discussion about garnishment and other amendments. But without a doubt, Section 14, where the garnishment issue resides, got more discussion and more amendments than any other area. And if I may, this might add some clarity. The process that MLAC followed was basically to go through all of the amendments that were provided, amendment suggestions that were provided, and what they did was accept. They made proposals on ones that they wanted to accept, and the discussion that they did have were on the ones that they either ended up accepting or the few that they had discussion on that they rejected, that a member of MLAC proposed to be accepted. I can't comment on garnishment because it was not proposed as an amendment by an MLAC member, but it certainly was proposed and discussed by the public in front of MLAC.
Okay. I'm scanning the room, Rob. Don't leave yet. I'm trying to figure out who to ask to come up here because it was the self-insured that seemed to have the biggest objection to the garnishment for part of this bill. And in absence of anyone else to speak for that group, Rob, would you want to come up and invite this Senator Decker?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it might be helpful. I was uncomfortable with the garnishment language also. It might be helpful to have the opponents, if they're in the room, also describe their rationale for why they didn't want those amendments.
The opponents to the amendments?
To any language on garnishment or Section 14.
If we can identify who that would be, we could...
I'm trying to...
Rob, go ahead and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Self-Insurers Association, and you are correct. Some of our members did testify against the garnishment provision in this committee. They're currently discussing within the self-insureds what stance they're going to take when the bill comes out of MLAC. It was not something that was addressed by MLAC. I have to say some of the members still do have a very strong feeling against that garnishment provision. Whether that will be in the amendments that we'll bring you when we see the full MLAC bill or not, I just don't know yet.
Okay. Are you proposing, are you thinking of proposing additional amendments in that section to present to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We have about, I think, 5 amendments, but we're waiting to see what the language is as it comes out of MLAC, because some of that may be resolved by the choice of language and what comes out of MLAC.
You mean out of legislative council?
I'm sorry. That's correct.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on behalf of why garnishment wasn't changed? Oh, we have a volunteer. John, I don't think you need to leave. I tried. Go ahead, JL. Enlighten us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm JL Wilson with NFIB and co-chair of MLAC. The employer side debated the garnishment piece at length amongst ourselves. And although I'm not particularly fond of seeing it in statute, I recognize it's a necessity, and I'll just give you a laundry list of reasons. First of all, an insurer can garnish anyway, and in fact, an insurer can garnish real property. What you notice in this bill is this this restricts an insurer from garnishing real property and can in fact only garnish wages. So you can in fact argue that it's a protection to the employee in instances of where their claim is denied and they're on the hook for that amount of money. Also, as is common practice, you'll also notice in the bill that the first avenue of recovery will be liens against future claims if it's determined that that the employee will in fact is a likely candidate for future workers' comp claims. That is the first avenue of recovery is with liens against those workers' comp recovery. So I was satisfied that that would dilute the garnishment provision sufficient enough to make me comfortable. Also, I just believe, just as a matter of accountability, that to have that in statute is one thing I suppose an employer has to make sure that the interim meds aren't accessed in a fraudulent manner. And so I give you 3 reasons why we decided to keep it. The labor side of the committee probably wouldn't have had any objections had we taken it out, and we probably were leaning that way too until we discussed it at length. So there's, I just need to give you a reason, and there are some reasons.
Thank you. Ken Hector, who was represented the self-insureds on MLAC, was obviously in your discussions.
Correct.
Was it somewhat, this is an option. This is not a mandate that you have to garnish. That's correct.
Correct.
Okay. Was that somewhat alleviate the concerns that maybe some of the self-insurers had that it would be at their discretion if they chose to garnish or not? So the big concern that I heard, and I think the committee heard, was that that's the quickest way to destroy a relationship between a worker and his employer.
Chair Beyer, I understand that completely, but insurers have the capability of garnishing anyways. And Mr. Hector was, we were unanimous in our decision to keep that provision as is because, first, it's optional. Second, you could argue it was a protection because it protects an employee's real property. Third, it was an accountability tool for the employer.
Okay.
Chair Beyer, the 14-day denial issue, I think, also provides an avenue for the insurer to not have any interim medical benefit payments if it's clear that the worker is that the claim is not compensable, or they are not the responsible insurer, or the worker is filing a claim against some employer they do not work for. So it's probably going to limit, having the 14-day denial piece in there will limit the amount of claims where garnishment would occur. And then secondly, just to specifically answer your question, a self-insured employer is going to have the choice on garnishment.
Self-insured.
Okay. Senator Decker.
John, do we have a sense of, on the 14-day, what percentage of those cases would fall into that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I think I do have some statistics for you. on that. What did I do with that? Well, I'm not accessing in my completely organized binder like I thought I would. I can get you that information if, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I'd send that to Mr. Putman and should be able to get that to the committee first thing tomorrow morning.
Yes, any requests that we make, just write them through Mr. Putman.
What I can basically provide the percentage of claims today that are denied within 14 days, and I think that's probably the best predictor of what would happen in the future.
Do you know ballpark how many, I mean, because I guess that is helpful in terms of the whole Section 14 question. I guess once we get the information, we've got it.
Thank you. Go ahead, John. We got a little bit left to go, I think.
The last part relates to basically the applicability of the bill, which is essentially relates to a question that you had asked earlier, Mr. Chair. When should the bill be effective? And most importantly, when should each of these parts of the bill apply on which claims? This is a complex and technical issue, and it has different answers depending on the different parts of the bill that you're looking at. MLAC has not completed its review or amendments in this particular area. This is the one area that they still need to finish in regard to applicability. My read on it is there's a tremendous amount of agreement at this point on what needs to be done, and it won't hold up legislative council in terms of the rest of the amendments that need to be done. It breaks into essentially four areas. Number one, does the bill need an emergency clause or not? And you had asked that question before. Number two, most parts of the bill ought to become effective on the date of the act and apply to all claims with dates of injury on or after the effective date of the act, in relationship to issues of compensability. That's pretty clear that you can't change the rules in the middle of the game. You have to pick a date, and then it applies to all claims from there on. There are also parts of the bill where we need to just pick an operative date, such as the effective date of the act, and that those parts of the bill become active or apply to those parts of the claim. An example of that would be new or omitted condition claims, or the refusal of modified job offers, or when workers can give a deposition. And then the fourth part is in regard to the Employers Liability Act, and my understanding is that the tentative agreement around that issue is to basically pick the same applicability for that part as applies on the so-called Johansson fix or the new and omitted condition claims. So that would just be a quid pro quo issue.
Good job. Okay. Thank you very much for taking us through this.
You're very welcome.
What you've done. I think there are a couple of small requests that you can get to Mr. Putman tomorrow or whenever, as soon as possible, and we can work on those. Committee members, is there anything about this you would like to add, subtract, multiply, or divide when in our directions to Legislative Council as far as amendments?
Arthritis. Can we have JL talk to that also? We'll just get to that thing.
Yeah, JL. He'll put you on the spot again.
Could you walk us through the bill one more time?
Senator Harper has a question about the arthritis.
Can you just give us a conversation regarding the arthritis decision? Why you want to kick this to the courts?
Chair Beyer, Senator Harper, we just decided that there was sufficient legal precedent that determined what arthritis meant, and that in that sense it was defined in law in case law that in fact we just let that rule today.
Yeah, that was the question John couldn't answer. There is
adequate case law out there right now.
Well, I was sufficiently pleased that there was, yeah.
Okay. So, for example, if a person goes to the doctor, injured worker, the doctor writes back on it that this person has arthritis in his wrist and he's got a wrist injury now, that would be sufficient reason under current case law that we don't have to define what arthritis is in the bill, that the insurer can kick it out and say it's arthritis, that's not covered.
Well, as you describe it, that sounds plausible, yeah.
Mr. Keene.
Shifts the burden.
What?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Jerry Keene, attorney, I was involved in some of the struggling over the wording on the arthritis issue over the course of the summer and then had suggestions during the MLAC proceedings. And I also do appellate workers' comp law and have for 20 years. So in terms of the answer to your question about whether there's precedent, there's certainly usage. There's usage and practice among workers' compensation doctors and lawyers and insurance companies as to what arthritis or arthritic conditions are. And really, arthritis isn't the problem. It's what constellation of related conditions do you consider to be arthritic conditions. And on that, doctors disagree. They have different definitions from each other. We all have a general sense of what we mean by it when we use it in the workers' comp industry, and I think the sense was that the workers' comp board will develop that in conjunction with lawyers, both working on doctors to get the definitions they want, to make it come out to one that we can all live with, just like other medical terms have generally become defined through case law and usage. The problem was is that initially the bill contained just a straight medical dictionary definition of arthritis alone, and in my opinion that was too narrow because it didn't account for arthritic conditions, but the doctors wanted arthritis because that meant something symptomatic, specific, but way narrower than has usually been used in the workers' comp cases. So I think the bottom line was you couldn't come to an agreement between the people who were conservative about that term and the ones who were less conservative about that term. They decided to let the board work it out as a matter of specialized expertise, case by case. They're going to get testimony about what it means in that particular case, and they're going to have to come to a decision over time. We'll narrow it down to where it won't be litigated that often.
I was just nervous when we were giving judges and lawyers latitude, but
there were definitions proposed, and basically it wasn't a matter of not being able to define it. People came up with definitions. It was whose definition you liked, considering your philosophy, and they decided not to try to get into the philosophy question because both labor and management had to agree on any changes, and they couldn't, so they both agreed to drop it.
Okay. Thanks. John?
Mr. Chair, just on that, so is there case law on this? I mean, I didn't hear in your answer that there was case law with the definition.
There is nothing I would call a case law definition of arthritis. There are a lot of cases who discuss the meaning of arthritis in that particular case, and so there's a trend. But no, there's no. I couldn't quote it for you because uh-huh. it's used in particular case contexts. Over time, there will be the courts will come up with some language, and that will start becoming the common law of comp definition of arthritis, because now they will need to come up with something that they will use as a touchstone as they return to the issue over and over again. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court will come up with some language we'll all start getting comfortable with.
Okay. John, I think you said that you are going through the whole bill and reevaluating costs and effects on the system. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Is this going to significantly change the estimate of cost to the system positively or negatively by not putting the definition of arthritis in the bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that's going to significantly change our estimates. No.
Okay. Jerry might disagree.
Well, I just need to say that this isn't a minor issue, that according to the major contributing cause study, about 46% of all of the denials that involved combined conditions involved arthritis or an arthritic condition. So we have plenty of opportunities to visit it and develop the case law that we're talking about. It's not minor at all. It's a major issue in terms of the exception to the pre-existing condition changes.
Mr. Chair, perhaps I should explain why I said it wouldn't change our estimate of the impact. I agree with Jerry. It's not a minor issue. Our estimate of the impact was based on the assumption that you can deny a claim currently
under the so-called arthritis exception. It's just it's a pre-existing condition. It can be used as a basis for denial today. What will change under this law are some other issues in regard to whether or not a condition has been previously treated, whether it's been previously diagnosed, those sorts of things. And arthritis is excepted from that. So to me, the way we looked at our cost estimates was that what's going to change is there's a certain amount of claims today that are denied and successfully defended under the pre-existing condition standard. And we're really not changing that standard in relationship to arthritis. So my answer to that would be no. I don't see that changing my cost impact estimates. I completely agree with Jerry. It's a large issue.
Okay. Any other questions about? Thank you. I think we're.
You're welcome.
Let you off the hook for a little while. So now you can. Well, I think. Are these going to be presented as a single amendment or 12 or 14 different amendments? Or
so at this time, Mr. Chairman, I don't know why I can't take wait a little bit and see how comfortable John is with this, which he did overnight. And it would be my suggestion that we send his document to Legislative Council along with John's phone number.
No, along with
and
John.
Ask him to go to along with John. John and John's phone number. Yeah. And ask him to go to work.
Okay.
The question I would raise, and I know it's an unfair question, and that's how quickly do you want them to turn this around?
We don't need it till Friday, man.
Yeah. I think they said MLAF wasn't going to be ready for it until March 1st. That gives them at least a week.
We're going to be here till August.
Senator Corkin's planning on being here in August, but the rest of us aren't, so I don't know what he's going to be doing sitting over there, but that's up to him.
Well,
voting on your budget.
The people that signed my check asked me to be careful about pushing Legislative Council until the 26th of March.
March?
of February, because of the backlog of bills still in the House. And you heard Mr. Cheech say the other day that he had 58 bills still on his desk in 12 days. Well, I don't know what his count is now, but I don't know why I can't just up and ask him to get it done by the 1st. That's why I get the big bucks. And well, all he can do is say no, and then you can go ask him.
I would hope that we would have it at least one day prior to the MLAC meeting to give those people a chance to digest it before they have to go in and give it their final blessing.
Yeah, and it may be possible, if I could ask the Chairman John a question or two. I think some of this is going to be fairly easy for Legislative Council, and some is going to require some serious head-scratching and head-knocking, maybe, as to just what that product looks like. So what I'm suggesting is that if council is willing to do it, draft sections could maybe come out for whatever. Am I making any sense at all?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putman, yes. I'm following you, and I agree that
there's two of you now.
there are parts of this that are going to be relatively straightforward because MLAC has provided the specific language that they're suggesting. And I don't think that's going to be too controversial. But you're right. Some areas are going to take some work. But I don't see why Legislative Council couldn't do it in pieces if that's the committee's pleasure.
Okay, well, I think the committee seems, the sense I've gotten is the committee would like to look at this as a single amendment, this part of it. There may be other amendments that are proposed, but this package we would like to see as a single amendment to the bill. So if it has to come out in pieces to let the people look at it, that's fine. But I think when we look at it again, we want to see it as one. Senator Corcoran.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think that's correct. I mean, I think this is the classic compromise, so it should be built into one document. And the other thing is I don't think there's any real rush. Maybe August is hyperbole, but we are going to be here for a while, and we may as well get it right. And the, you know, the people that are have been poring over this for the interim, so, I mean, it's not like we can turn these, need to turn these amendments around right away. I don't think there's any real hurry.
No, I understand what you're saying. I'd just like to have them ready because MLAC is a volunteer group, unlike us, who the state police can drag us in here kicking and screaming if they so choose. We don't want to bring those people back endlessly. They've got a meeting scheduled, if at all possible, for legislative council to have that back for them. I would certainly encourage that. Thank you again, John.
You're welcome.
I think Rob has testified that there probably will be some other amendments proposed. And I don't know how many other groups out there have got other amendments to propose. Certainly, this is an open system. Anyone can propose amendments, and it's our job at that point in time to look at them all individually and reject or accept as we see fit. We are not here strictly to rubber stamp what an independent body does, i.e. MLAC. We are get paid the big bucks to use our sound judgment.
Only be the third one today.
I don't think I was as responsive as I could have been to Senator Deckard's question about definition of arthritis. I did take a stab at writing what I thought the courts would come up with, just to predict it, and I can provide that to you. So,
okay.
That'd be great.
Okay. You couldn't finish it because he had carpal tunnel.
One thing that, for the committee's own knowledge, one thing that still concerns me greatly is removing the two sunsets in the bill that are currently in law, and I still have concerns with doing that at this point in time. So I will ask for an amendment to be drafted to leave those two sunsets in place. Currently they expire, or they kick off, I think, at January 1st, 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So that would give the legislature another opportunity to look at that issue in 2003 on those sunsets. So that's a concern I personally have. So just for your information, that will be an amendment that's drafted for us to consider as a committee. Okay. Anything else on Senate Bill 45? Hearing none, we will close the work session. And it looks like we're ready to get back into accounting, huh? Mm-hmm.
What else do we have on the agenda for Friday?
The rest of these accounting bills, state house bills.
Okay. Well, members, I'll let you guys get some input here. We're scheduled to do these accounting bills on Friday. We can forge ahead now and keep working, or we can work on Friday. Okay, there was one vote for Friday.
Forge ahead.
One vote for forge ahead. Atkinson says he doesn't care because he's already excused on Friday.
We'll have a forum on Friday.
We will have a forum on Friday. Let's call it a night. We'll come back and deal with these issues on Fridays. I think we're going to get some amendments anyway need to be proposed. So thank you for the attentive committee, and we'll see you on Friday.